This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, this is Santa with some exciting news. I've got a podcast.
Yes. Merry Christmas,
every day in December, I'll update you with all that's happening here in the North Pole. Plus, Santa Maury will be telling us all about the science of Christmas. And you can ask me a question in Ask Santa Anything. Just search for The Santa Daily. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and, well, pretty much everywhere. The Santa Daily. It's Christmas in a podcast. I do hope you enjoy listening to it. Have a very Merry Christmas. And from the North Pole, this is Santa. Over and out.
Right, brains on, ears open, eyes wide, heads down. Let's do it. Another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the show where we talk about the most amazing and wondrous things out there in the universe. Thank you very much for giving us a listen. My name's Dan. I will be your guide on today's journey to the most deadly parts of the universe. Now, actually, today we're talking about what happens when two of the most dangerous things in space meet each other. Also, we'll hear about a probe that has reached the edge of our solar system, and there's a way that you can actually make me take over, like, the proper music charts. I'm on a mission to be the Christmas number one. You can help me out with that in a little bit. It's on the way after we catch up with our favourite genius from Fun Kids, Professor Hallex, and this time he's looking at how to make you better.
Professor Hallex's kaleidoscopic antibiotic.
This laboratory is in a terrible state. I know that Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin in a mucky petri dish, but that's not an excuse to leave the washing up in the sink. Prevention is always better than cure.
Suppose it could use a spring clean, couldn't it? Ouch! I've cut myself!
Oh, Professor, that looks nasty. I think we'll need to get the doctor to take a look at this.
I agree. It really hurts. Hey! Look over there. It's Great Uncle Halitosis. What's he doing here?
Oh, he did tell me he was getting his flu jab. You know, a vaccination. Flu is a very nasty viral infection. Vaccinations are offered to people who are especially at risk, like children and the elderly.
I tell you what, nurse. Vaccinations are incredibly interesting. Isn't that so, computer?
Vaccines are used to help prevent bacterial and viral infections. They work by stimulating white blood cells to produce antibodies to fight certain diseases. If the vaccinated person then comes into contact with the actual disease, their immune system will recognize it and immediately produce the antibodies or cells they need to fight it. Thanks to vaccines, some infectious diseases like polio and smallpox have been virtually wiped out. The main ingredient of any vaccine is either dead or weakened versions of the disease-causing virus or bacteria.
Hey, Nanobot! Why don't you shrink yourself down with a heli-telly bubble and take a peek inside Uncle Halitosis so you can see the vaccine in action? Go on, quickly, before he leaves.
Okay, should be interesting.
Heli-telly bubble, ready to launch in 3, 2, 1.
Well, I can see the flu antigen attached to the weakened influenza viruses. Ah, his body has detected that something is up. Here come the lymphocytes.
Lymphocytes are white blood cells which attack harmful microbes. B lymphocytes are coated in different Y-shaped antibodies. An antibody is a kind of protein, and there are thousands, if not millions, of different types of antibodies produced by the immune system. Bacteria cells and viruses have antigens on their surface. When the right antibody connects with the right antigen, like a lock and key, the cell will be destroyed.
I don't think the white blood cells have found a match yet. Oh, there we we go. The antibodies on that white blood cell match the antigens on one of the flu vaccine viruses. The white blood cell is quickly making lots of copies of itself, and those copies produce the correct antibody to kill the vaccine viruses. It won't be long until they've eradicated all of the weakened virus vaccines. Copies of these cells are kept in the blood so that if the real flu virus does appear, your body will know how to combat it.
Like puzzle pieces. That's Uncle Halitosis sorted now. No need to worry about the flu now.
That's not quite so, Professor. Although some vaccines do last for a lifetime, others need boosters to remind your white blood cells of the right codes to combat the pathogens. The flu virus is so clever, it keeps changing. It is therefore important to get a completely new vaccine every year.
Professor Halleck, turn 3.
Hey, up! The doctor's ready for me. Better get yourself back here, nurse.
Vaccinations are a part of modern life. Many are given as an injection or nasal spray when you are a child. You will have had them to protect yourself from diseases like mumps, rubella, and whooping cough.
That's right. It's important that as many people as possible get the right vaccinations. That way we can protect the more vulnerable people in our communities and even eradicate some diseases altogether.
And don't forget what I said earlier, Professor. Prevention is better than cure. The more effort we make to stay healthy and practice good hygiene, like washing hands regularly, the less chance these infections will have to spread in the first place. And talking of good hygiene...
You're suggesting I give the old laboratory a good clean?
You've got it in one.
Professor Halleck's Kaleidoscopic Antibiotic, with support from eBug and Public Health England. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Halleck's or visit e-bug.eu.
You can find out how to save one of the UK's favourite species in just a sec. First, let's say a quick hello to some people who have left us a review over on the Fun Kids, over on the iTunes podcast store for the Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got a question that you want a proper science expert to answer, leave it on there. I'll find it, I'll have a read, and I'll find the perfect genius to answer it for you. Nell from Crewe wants to know why we float in water. I can actually answer this one for you now. It's all to do with the air in our body, because we've got loads. You know, when you breathe in, there's loads of air, loads of oxygen, a lot of nitrogen, some carbon dioxide in there, in your lungs and stuff. And all of that is lighter than the water that you're swimming in. Actually, you can show this. There's an example. Next time that you're in the swimming pool or something, hold your breath, and then you'll float. But when you blow it out... you'll feel yourself sinking lower and lower and lower because there's no air in your body that's keeping you afloat. Thanks, Nell. Also, massive thank you to the 5 stars, which is another brilliant way if you want a shout out from us. Leave the Fun Kid Science Weekly 5 stars there. Also, hello to Grace in Australia. Ella, hello to you. You're in Australia as well. I really love the fact that the things that I am saying right now in my studio in London, in the UK, is heard by people all around the world and even gets down under. I love it. Brilliant questions from you girls as well. I promise I will find an answer to them for you over in the new year on the show. If you've got something that you want a proper expert to answer for you, you need to leave the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review over on the iTunes podcast store. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, two authors, they're inviting explorers to search and to save one rare and distinctive animal. We know it so well, but we don't know too much about it. Hedgehogs Don't Live in the City. It's by Lucy Reynolds and Jenna Herman. And Lucy is on the show to tell us more. Hey, Lucy.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when you started writing the book, what did you want people to get out of it when they had finished it?
I think I just wanted to help children to become aware of hedgehogs as something incredibly special and rare and something that's really in need of our help. Hedgehogs are the nation's favourite animal. They're extremely difficult to spot. They're nocturnal. They like to hide away under piles of leaves. They don't come out at the times when children are out and about. So not many children have seen one, but lots of children are excited about them. And I wanted them to come away with a sense of how they can help this species that's facing decline.
Now, I'll be honest. So, as you said, they're the nation's most loved mammal. But when you think of a hedgehog, you don't really think they're that special and you don't really think they're that rare. So what is it about it that why are they so, I guess, misunderstood?
I think it's a range of things. Partly it's the fact of their rarity. So since the millennium, hedgehog numbers have declined 30%, research suggests. So a number of surveys and research studies have been carried out recently by bodies such as the British Hedgehog Preservation Society and the People's Trust for Endangered Species. And although it's really difficult to track hedgehogs because they're shy, nocturnal and non-territorial, they are all, through looking at sort of reported sightings and even data such as roadkill statistics, they are all showing a decline that's consistent, so a fast downward trend in terms of population numbers. And I think the other thing is just their uniqueness. They're our only spiny mammal. They're little. They're only up to about 30 centimetres long. They're very quiet and shy. They have a little snout like a pig, so they're quite unusual. They like grubbing about for slugs and worms. They're a gardener's best friend, really, in terms of looking after garden landscapes and managing worms and slugs and little kind of creatures like that. But yeah, they're rare. They're hard to spot and they are under real threat.
You said that just it's our only spiny, spiky mammal. Why is that, do you think? I mean, when we see mammals that we know, we see a lot of similarities, don't we? You know, horses, donkeys kind of look the same thing. Dogs, foxes kind of look the same.
Yeah.
Why do hedgehogs have the spikes and why are they alone in that?
It's a quirk of evolution, I think. They're almost a prehistoric type of animal, and their spines, they have about 6,000 spines. So each hedgehog has 6,000 of these little banded, hard little spikes, and they serve a protective function. So a hedgehog, when under threat, will roll up tight into a curled up little ball, and that means that all the way around it, it's got this amazing armoury of spikes, which make it difficult for a predator to attack. And although in terms of evolution, that's been an extremely effective means of self-protection, the trouble is that they're now living in a landscape where humans are involved. And obviously when hedgehogs evolved, we didn't have wheels and cars and fast-moving objects in the way that we do now. So unfortunately, a hedgehog's self-defense mechanism is also its own worst enemy in a built environment. Because if you're on a road and you curl up tight and stay still, your chance of being hit by a car are much higher than if you're a fox, for instance, that has a strong fight or flight instinct and runs away from that threat. So a hedgehog doesn't have a fight or flight reaction. It curls up and it stays still, and that makes it very vulnerable. And that's one factor that's contributing to its decline.
Well, what are the other factors then? If us humans, even though they're our most loved mammal, why are we causing their numbers to decline so rapidly?
Well, that depends where we're looking at. In terms of hedgehog habitats. So almost unexpectedly, hedgehogs are declining a little bit less quickly in urban landscapes than they are in rural landscapes. So if you think about the word hedgehog, it's a combination of the word hedge and the word hog. Hog from its pig-like snout and the way it sort of digs about in the earth for worms and grubs and caterpillars, hedge from its natural habitat. They like to nest and also find shelter and protection in hedgerows and banks traditionally. If you're looking at a rural landscape, which is increasingly becoming farmed intensively, you're quite often now finding that hedgerows themselves are disappearing, field sizes are getting much larger. And you're also finding a decline in biodiversity. So as farmers are starting to spray their crops more and more, the invertebrates and the little grubs and slugs and earthworms that hedgehogs traditionally sort of grub about for are less and less in numbers. So not only in rural areas, they're not only losing their nesting habitat in terms of hedgerows, they're also losing their food source in terms of grubs. And then if you look at the urban landscape, you've got different factors that are causing hedgehog decline and sort of make it difficult for them. So there you have a network of garden fences. If you think of looking at the city from above, there are lots of little boxed off gardens. And hedgehogs actually every night need to roam between 1 and 2 kilometres to find the food source that they need to sustain their body mass. So they need to roam a long way. It's very hard in a built-up environment. You have roads and you have sort of cars and threats in that respect in cities as well. And you also have a lot of people now keeping their gardens very ship-shape. So piles of leaves and twigs and logs are disappearing as people tidy up. Decking and paving are going down, which makes it again hard to grub about for slugs. And slug pellets are scattered about a lot, not only reducing that food source for hedgehogs, but also presenting a poisoning risk. So depending whether you're looking at a rural or an urban landscape, there are many different factors that are making it quite tricky for these little mammals.
It's crazy, and it makes perfect sense now you've explained it, that they're declining much faster in those rural landscapes. I could easily place the reasons why perhaps in urban areas we were destroying their habitats, but to think of them out in nature, in the wild, out in the country, and their habitat, where they're living, their environment is still being destroyed by us, it's kind of a surprisingly shocking thought. Mm. I know that you occasionally do see a hedgehog out and about during the day, but you said they're nocturnal animals. Does that mean we shouldn't be seeing them?
Exactly. If you see a hedgehog in the daytime, most likely it's in real trouble. So you almost want to hope that you don't see one in the day. If you do spot one in the daytime, there are certain things you can do. So if you think that it's in trouble, you need to ask an adult or yourself, if you feel comfortable to wear gardening gloves to protect from the prickles. Bring it in, pop it in a little cardboard box, give it a warm but not hot, hot water bottle, so it's got a heat source, wrap that in a towel and then put in an old fleece or a towel in the box so it's got something it can hide under and shelter under. And then you need to put in that box a little dish of water, never milk, and a little bowl of meaty cat or dog food. Hedgehogs are carnivores, so it needs to be meat, not dry biscuit. And then pop that in a quiet, safe spot and phone the British Hedgehog Preservation Society, and they will be able to tell you exactly what to do. They'll have a list of local hedgehog rescue centres that can give you advice or where you can take the hedgehog if you think it's really unwell. So yes, if you see a hedgehog out in the daytime, it's not a very good sign. They should definitely be tucked up asleep.
What if they're not in distress? What if we don't see them in the daytime? How do we help them out when we're tucked up in bed but they're roaming around at night? What can we do to make sure they're fine?
At the back of our book, there's a section called Help Our Hedgehogs, and that gives you a nice sense of how you can help. And there are a number of easy ways. So one goes back to what I was talking about in terms of garden management. And there's a big national campaign called Hedgehog Street, which launched in 2011. And this is all about trying to encourage people across the country to make their gardens hedgehog friendly. There are 47,000 hedgehog champions out there at the moment, mainly children, who've all signed up to do what they can to help. And so what they're doing are things like leaving leafy, twiggy piles in the garden that make nice nesting sites for hedgehogs, leaving piles of wood and twigs and logs that make nice kind of grub hotels, so a nice biodiverse ecosystem that slugs and grubs can live within. You can help to make a hedgehog highway. So if you have a garden or know somebody who does, you can encourage the adult who owns it to cut a little CD-sized hole in all of the garden fences, about 13 centimetres across, so that a hedgehog can squeeze through that hole, and you're helping to join up all the gardens that help it to roam and to forage at night. You can sign a massive petition that's being run by change.org at the moment, and that's all about making these hedgehog highways mandatory, compulsory within urban planning legislation, so that every single new building development has to have joined up garden fences. And you can make a little hedgehog hotel, so you can, in your little leafy kind of pile of leaf and twigs, you can leave a dish of clean water and meaty dog or cat food. Hedgehogs do require a bit of supplementary feeding through the year, so they tend to hibernate between November and March. but they do move nesting sites sometimes in the winter. And so if they wake up in the winter and there aren't many slugs and grubs about, a bit of supplementary feeding helps. When they're preparing to hibernate, it's extremely helpful as well. And then when they're starting to breed between April and September, again, just that little bit of boost in terms of finding that meaty dog and cat food and a bit of water can really help them plump up and get through.
Because it's not just for the hedgehog's sake, is it, that what we know so much about creatures in the wild, in the environment, is that it's all part of one big cycle. So us helping out hedgehogs will also help out the animals. I know it sounds sad, but the animals that need the hedgehogs to survive so they can survive.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, the book is Hedgehogs Don't Live in the City, written by Lucy Reynolds. The amazing, just the most bright, brilliant pictures that you've ever seen by Jenna Herman. Lucy, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about some of the most mean and evil things in the universe. I put on a scary voice just for that, actually. This week, we're headed to space to find out what happens when two of the most dangerous things in the universe collide. Firstly, let's remind ourselves what a supernova is. It's what happens when a star dies. It explodes in a blaze of light, and it can radiate more energy in that split second than our sun will in its entire lifetime. Also, a black hole is a part of space-time where the gravity is so strong that nothing can escape. And when you put both of those together, a black hole and a supernova, you get a hypernova. It's when a supermassive star reaches the end of its life and the gravity becomes so strong that its core collapses directly into a black hole. Then the energy inside is released at a rapid rate. It explodes with two jets of plasma that move at the speed of light. They emit gamma radiation, and it's just ridiculously massive and dangerous. And it's actually still a curiosity, because as with loads of space science, it's all just a theory. Scientists, they have seen some evidence of this, but most of it is just equations and sums on a blackboard somewhere that help us figure out what's happening. They think it really does exist, that these things do happen. But the best news is that it only happens to hypergiant planets, massive ones, which are over 100 times bigger than our sun. And they only happen once every 200 million years. So you'll be really unlucky to be part and sucked up and exploded by a hypernova. But knowing that they're out there, that is truly dangerous. Just a very quick break from science, but I really need you to help me out, right? In the UK, the Christmas number one in the music charts is a very big deal. You know, we've had Band-Aid, we've had Slade, we've had, last year actually, Ed Sheeran, he managed to get it by selling 83,000 copies of Perfect, which if you think about it, doesn't sound so many. 83,000! So, a group of us podcasters, we've got together and we're trying to become this year's Christmas number one. We've started something called Pod-Aid, and we've made a song. It's called Sounds of Christmas, and it features loads of the best British podcasters, from us at the Fun Kids Science Weekly, to the Beef and Dairy Network, to Writer's Routine, to the Two Shot Podcast, to Comedians Comedian, and all of the proceeds go towards Samuel's charity, and it helps kids who are underfunded in children's wards in hospitals have a better standard of life, really. The idea is, if all the best shows in the UK team up, and if we pool all of our audience together, you know, you, other podcasters' audience as well, surely we've got to have over 83,000 listeners all together. And we've got a slight chance of being the actual Christmas number one for the UK in 2018. So have a listen to this clip. It's called Sounds of Christmas. This is the song. And if you live in the UK, I'd love for you to get involved. Maybe buy it, give some money to the charity and help us out. Just imagine if a bunch of podcasters managed to hack the chart.
Christmas is still inside my head. So turn off the
So there you go. It's called Sounds of Christmas by Pod Aid. And it's all just so much fun, and it's for a worthwhile cause as well. All the proceeds go to charity. So stream it, buy it if you can, and help us win the battle of the Christmas number one spot. Right, enough of that. Let's get back to science, shall we? And look to the sky and find out what's happening with the weather with Marina Ventura.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there, Marina Ventura here. I love finding out about the natural world, and that includes the Earth's climate. We know that weather can change from one day to the next, but climates can change too over the time span of years, centuries, or even longer. So I'm on a mission to fill MapApp with the latest climate information with the help of some awesome climate explorers. Come on then, let's go. I bet your parents tell you that fresh air's good for you, right? Especially if you've been indoors for a long time. A nice, big, deep breath of air can certainly feel refreshing. The air around us is all part of the atmosphere, and without it, there wouldn't be any life on Earth at all.
That's right, Marina. The Earth's atmosphere is made up of layers of gases. These include nitrogen, a gas which is harmless to humans, and oxygen, which almost all life needs to live. It also contains gases like carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and help keep the planet warm enough for life, a bit like a blanket. You've probably heard of something called the greenhouse effect. It's another way to describe the effect that the blanket of gases has. Without the greenhouse effect, the Earth would be, on average, more than 30 degrees colder than it is today. Way too cold for life to survive. Brrr. Gases that help trap the heat are called greenhouse gases. But scientists studying the atmosphere have shown that some human activities, such as burning fossil fuels or chopping down rainforests, are increasing the amount of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, which is causing the climate to change.
Luckily, there are climate explorers like Hannah to help us find out more. Let's say hello.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm an atmospheric scientist. My work is all about developing and looking after instruments that help monitor different things in our atmosphere. Me and my measuring instruments fly up to 10 kilometres high in the sky on board a special aircraft that takes measurements up in the clouds. The instruments are fitted to both the plane's body as well as its wings and include lasers that measure clouds, small particles and fog.
A special laboratory in the air sounds really cool. So what do you measure?
Well, as well as temperature, we also measure humidity, that's how much water vapour there is, and turbulence and wind, that's all to do with how quickly or slowly the atmosphere is moving around. We can also measure tiny particles like smoke and dust, and even check the level of electricity in the air, something which is connected to thunderstorms.
So what do you do with all the information you collect?
It's used in lots of ways, but it can be really helpful for learning about changes to our climate. The measurements we collect are used by scientists across the world to learn as much as possible about our atmosphere today and what effects humans are having on it. And with the data collected over many years, scientists can use the information to help see changes over time and predict what might happen in the future.
Sounds amazing, Hannah. And that plane full of gadgets sounds like a lot of fun. And what a great way to see the effect of changes in our climate. Ready for upload, Mappy?
Load me up.
Next time, we'll be back on dry land, or should I say muddy land, finding out more about how studying the Earth can help us learn more about the Earth's climate. See you soon.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Time to talk about all the science that's been in the news this week. Scientists are getting closer to understanding the tsunami that struck Indonesia back in September. Waves rushed ashore after an earthquake, but researchers were surprised by the size of these waves. They weren't expecting it. But a survey of the Earth under the seabed shows a movement of the crust upwards. It rises a little bit, and they think that produced the huge wave. Also, NASA says it has detected signs of glaciers melting in Antarctica. The region on the east of the continent has been considered stable and unaffected by global warming for some time, but satellites have now shown ice streams running into the ocean, which are speeding up as well. And if this continues, it will cause ocean levels to rise, which will have devastating consequences for the rest of the world. And finally, the Voyager 2 probe, which left Earth 40 years ago back in 1977, has finally left the solar system. It's now in interstellar space, along with its twin, Voyager 1, after it's passed the sun's protective magnetic field. It's 11 billion miles from Earth. It's moving at 34,000 miles an hour, and it will carry on studying uncharted space. Right, that is it for this week's episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If you're listening on iTunes and you've got a question for a proper science expert that you want answered, please do leave us a review over there. Just drop your name, give us 5 stars, there's a comment box at the bottom, and leave us a review. That would be amazing. I'll see it and I'll find a proper genius to help you out with that. Also on iTunes, it's one of the best places that you can find all of our amazing Fun Kids Science series. You can get it on the free Fun Kids app as well, and they're over at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. You can hear us on your DAB digital radio, also on that free Fun Kids app, and as always, at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.